Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Additive, Minneapolis. This is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark LaCroix. I, too, make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are friction by design and diversifying scoring. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start.
We all have games we've played recently.
Yes.
And we're going to talk about it. The one I've been playing is leading is segues into my topic.
Okay.
But that isn't always the most fun. Sometimes it's just nice to talk about what we played recently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'll go last.
Okay.
Steven.
We played Civ 7.
We all did.
We all did yesterday. Which was really fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Speak for yourself.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Mark, you had a hard time because you didn't get to control where you spawned because Dale had to play in the beginning for you, and then it was just kind of rough going.
Yeah, listeners have been following the now 6-week saga of me being sick.
Yeah.
I'm still, it's whatever. It just lasts forever.
Mm.
But I was feeling really rough yesterday when we did this.
Yeah.
So Dale started a game for me.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm just going to stay home. Like, it's, you know, there's enough people there. They can, you know, they can do anything on me. Dale calls and says, hey, so I've been playing for you, but like, I got to go. So,
yeah.
I'm like, okay. So I trudged in. And I picked up, and Dale had settled the Capital City, which he happily named
Capital City. Nice, good job.
Because you can rename cities now in Civ 7, one of my favorite features of Civ 6.
Couldn't do that before.
Oh, you could always do that in 4.
Well, in Civ games, yeah.
But oh,
In Civ 7, it didn't launch with that feature.
Right.
Oh.
It was in the early patch. I don't know why. It's whatever. So it goes.
Yeah.
But she settled it near 7 volcanoes.
Yeah, there were so many volcanoes.
I mean, 2 of them were inactive, but 7 volcanoes.
Oh, we should have done geologically active or like
Well, next time.
Next time.
Yeah. But it was rough going.
Yeah.
It became your brand.
No, it was fine. I was just a total grouch the whole time, which I'm sure was like kind of fun for everyone else if it wasn't also annoying. I don't know.
But Lydia, this is your first time playing, right?
Yes. So I did a quick test the day before to see if it worked on my laptop, which it did not. It was very laggy, and the video and the audio was desynced. So then I tried it out on the Steam Deck, and I did just enough turns before the AI started attacking me, and I said, nope, time to go to bed, just to get a sense of it. And I found that Steam Deck runs it very, very well, which is great. Two, there is enough... I mean, trying to figure out new UI, because again, I am used to Civilization 4 Golden.
Right.
Which was a while ago. Trying to figure out the UI and was hard without hover over states. And I couldn't figure out how to hover over the thing that I wanted to hover over with a joystick. So ended up being very, very good, because that meant I brought my Bluetooth mouse with me to the thing. Hooked it up to a monitor. It was awesome.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it. I took over. I had to come very late, like 4 hours late to the party. So I took over an AI who was Charlemagne, who was very militaristic. I was like, nah, we're not doing this. We're going expansion. I'm going to get lots of luxury. I play very expansionist when I play Civilization. So I was just happily settling things and making territory grow.
I guess we didn't mention that, although we implied it, but we did it all here at the office.
Yeah.
Which is kind of it's fun to do it online and, you know, like a Discord call. It's close enough.
Mm-hmm.
But it's nice to be all in the same room together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That privilege. It's
proper LAN party.
Yeah.
Really nice. Mm-hmm. We played it with a couple of our friends who also had not played Civ 7 before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they were
Only you and me had really played it before, like the night prior, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone did pretty good.
Mm-hmm. I think so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, picked it up. And, you know, they all had some Civ background, but.
Yeah.
If you are at all interested in playing Civilization 7, know that there is a difference between a town and a city.
Because
our friends didn't realize that.
No, and it's...
And I didn't explain it to them very well.
A whole new mechanic and not well explained.
Yeah.
Unless you go through, like, the tutorial, but then play for a while. But I don't think anyone had enough background before they started the multiplayer.
Yeah.
Which doesn't give you as much tutorialization.
Right.
Yeah.
So, just as a heads up, that's a thing. But yeah, Lydia, you have been playing a game... You said with your brother, right?
Yeah. So my brother got me for my birthday Age of Mythology Retold, which is very sweet of him because it released recently, so it's expensive. But also, like, a fair number of his gifts to me are very self-motivated because he really wanted to play it with me, and we only have the one copy in our Steam family share.
Okay.
So he got me a copy so we could play together.
Nice.
We've been playing Age of Mythology Retold. We played Age of Mythology when I was a kid, very much enjoyed it. And he was really interested in Age of Mythology because of the improved graphics, especially he loves the myth units, the monsters. I do too. And they've redone some of them to be very cool.
Okay.
And just, you know, even more gorgeous and cool than they were before. But something that I've been very interested to see, and he's also been very interested to see, is how they've actually improved and changed the game mechanics. So there is now more differentiation between the groups that you could play as. So you can play as the Greeks, the Atlanteans, the Egyptians, the Norse, and then if you get the DLC, the Chinese. I mean, they do play differently from each other, but they're now even more different. So you do genuinely have to switch strategies and think about how you're going to move around in the game differently, depending on which one you're playing. So like they gain favor differently. They have different units that get resources quickly or which ones build things. And that changes how you have to prepare and also how and how often and in what ways you battle. And then neither of us have the DLC, but we've seen some discussion online about the DLC and like the people commenting on the tutorials and stuff. The Chinese are now actually properly a different civilization type.
Ah, okay.
Because beforehand, the Chinese DLC was absolutely panned. Basically, it was a very weak reskin, kind of.
That's annoying.
It had a couple different units, but it was not different enough to warrant buying it.
Sure.
The Chinese now seem to be, I mean, I haven't played it again, but based on just the little 2-minute explanation tutorial about the Chinese, genuinely is its own thing. It feels more fleshed out. It feels like its own distinct entity and operational thing with its own resource gathering units, its own myth units, and its own combat units that you do have to think about in a different way when building your armies and building out your bases.
Cool.
Which is what it should have been in the first place. I'm very glad. I think that they've redeemed themselves. I'm curious to see if that's actually true.
Yeah.
But it's been fun. I, at some point, think I might want to try to replay the campaign. I'm absolutely garbage at real-time strategy games, so I have to play it on very easy. But I did enjoy the campaign a lot as a kid and finished it with my brother. So I might do that at some point. That would be fun.
Yeah, cool. That's awesome. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Boy, I don't play games with my brother like that at all.
we would always do the, like, I mean, I don't play multiplayer games really ever, but we would do the, we have done, Peter has very slowly become more open to multiplayer games as we've existed farther apart.
Okay.
But like growing up, what we would do is we would just sit next to each other, look at the same screen and co-op, essentially like couch co-op on a single player game,
sure,
including Civilization.
Yeah.
Like we would play Civ 4 all the time together.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
No, that's a unique gameplay experience with just like, you know, single player with someone else. Dale and I do that from time to time. It's really nice. Most of the time she'll drive those games.
Okay.
Which is kind of nice because then I can just sort of like, it's weird to be a spectator, but also kind of a backseat driver.
Yeah.
Like it's kind of that's a unique kind of fun with video games.
Mm-hmm. Because
like as long as you let go of like what actually happens. You
yeah.
know what I mean? Like, Dale gets to decide, but I also am not responsible for the consequences.
Right.
Yeah. I love it.
But I have to have input. It's nice. But then some people like to be more like a two-hander. They like to either trade off the controller or deliberate a lot more. There's different ways of doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do that with my husband a lot too.
Yeah.
And it, depending on what we're doing, that what game we're playing, will either someone will be the primary driver and someone will be the spectator, the passenger seat. Ian's playing Tales of Arise right now, and I'm in the passenger seat just crafting or whatever, and that's really fun. But for a game, we like to play puzzle games together that way. So Baba is you.
Yeah.
We will oftentimes, one person will start driving, and then someone will be kind of cogitating and say, okay, wait, can I borrow the controller? And
yeah, that's a good handoff one. That's a good example.
And it's really nice because with puzzle games, because I find I give up a lot slower because someone else is there. And so I actually, like, the impatient part of my brain that's like, this is too hard, I want to leave and try a new level, has just enough of a check that I sit on the problem long enough that then I have a chance to figure it out.
Ah,
right. You, the futility of it doesn't reach you as quickly.
Yes.
Because you're working as a team.
Yeah.
So there's like accomplishing something together feels like a real goal, whereas accomplishing a puzzle but yourself doesn't feel that real sometimes.
Yeah.
Like when it's really frustrating.
Yeah. Or you don't allow yourself to sit in that unsurety long enough for it to be realized.
Yeah. Well, speaking of puzzle games and eventual futility, I've been playing Blue Prince.
Oh, okay. I want to play it so
which,
bad.
Which our guest last week mentioned a couple of times. It's kind of right now where we're sitting. It's like just came out. It's a hot thing. A lot of people are really like jazzed about it. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's like has my favorite thing, which is non-linear narrative puzzles. Mm-hmm. I love that kind of gameplay. I love storytelling through revelatory mechanics. I like when you piece it together in a random order. Because to fill a larger picture, that is so great. But it also has my least favorite thing in games, which is it's a roguelike.
Yeah. Which is one of my favorites. And so I'm perfectly jazzed about this.
I feel you're probably going to like it, yeah. But no, it's the thing about a game when you combine those two things, and I don't know how many examples of a games have done this kind of thing, brought roguelike elements, but this game is very much a roguelike. Okay. In a way that like when people talked about it, they're like, oh yeah, it's a puzzle game. It's sort of like Myst, but like, it's a little bit more randomized, and it's got some roguelike stuff in it. And I'm like, okay, great, I can handle that.
Yeah.
Especially because those elements are actually part of what makes the puzzles kind of interesting.
Right, right.
In some ways.
Yeah.
That sort of like discovery and revelation and stumble upon-ness that roguelikes have, that's actually part of the puzzle stuff. They're well blended, I should say.
Okay.
Because I'm going to complain about it a lot. But like,
yeah.
Those mechanics are really well blended.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't realize it is just 100% a roguelike.
Okay.
Like, it is, you lose everything at the end of a run. Permanent upgrades are things you have to struggle for and then aren't worth it. Like, it's all the punishing RNG where you, like, everything that you've ever seen, you've dealt with, and then you spend this squishy middle rolling the dice until something new happens. It is just a total slog, and I feel like a lot of the elements of, for folks who don't know, you navigate this large country estate, and every room you roll and you get three possibilities, you draft, and then you choose one of them, and they have doors, they're all square rooms in a grid. Your goal is to get to the antechamber at the end of the house to reach the mythical 46th room, and I haven't beat this game, so it's a lot I don't know about the end game of it yet.
Sure.
But the paths through it are really just governed by randomness, but if you just try to make it there, you're not going to, because you need to solve puzzles to allow more types of rooms to be part of your draw deck, and you need to collect keys in certain rooms. So even though this room provides a better path, you shouldn't get it, because you know once you get that much further in the house, it's more likely that the doors will be locked. But it's, you don't know, it's random,
right?
And so it definitely, that's the roguelike part of it. It just becomes the puzzle part is really fascinating, where you get a clue in one room, but then that provides some answers in another room. Mm. And some of the puzzles are spread out, so you don't get a fuller picture, and that's very Myst-like.
Oh.
That kind of point-and-click adventure game, where the puzzles are really, really broad, and when it all clicks, it is kind of magical.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that it's randomized gives it a kind of charm to it, because you stumble upon a piece, and you're like, oh. And then you kind of go back to your notes, and you remember this fits with that, and you're like, oh, wow. And you got that piece third, but somebody else might have gotten it first.
Right.
So it has a very personalized experience.
Yeah.
But once those things happen, and then you're like, okay, now I know what I need to do. I need, this room has, this part of the grid has this, or I won't spoil all the mechanics, the things that you figure out, because actually knowing what to do with the mechanics is part of the puzzle.
Sure.
Which is really fascinating. But I'm in that part now where I feel like, all right, I'm sure there's a lot more. I have no idea how much more of the game is left, but there's a bunch of stuff I know I haven't reached yet. I haven't solved everything, certainly.
But you know what you want to do.
Well, but I've seen everything that I can see.
Oh, sure.
I have all the clues that I know I need to get a different room to find the second half of.
Oh, and now you're so just waiting for the
So I know that there's nothing left for me to solve. And I mean, I say I know that, but who's to say?
Sure.
But I know that the clue I have is half of a clue. Like, I know that for certain.
Right.
So I just need to roll the dice over and over and over again until I find a new room, then search for the second half, then it's like, oh, but you know what? Now I've run out of steps, because the game is very roguelike in the sense that you can build the path of the house, but also every time you move from room to room, you lose a counter.
Mm.
And once that gets to zero, you have to start over.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like, there's steps, and then there's, you collect keys, but then you lose all your keys at the end of the day. And then there's gems, which lets you choose certain types of rooms.
Mm-hmm.
There is just so many currencies and things to track that they're all scarce.
Mm.
And then at the end of the day, it all resets. Every bonus item you've collected that helps you unlock a certain thing, those all go back to the original rooms. You have to draw them again.
Oh, okay.
To get the thing again. Very, very punishing. And this is all very, that's the design of the game. It's,
right.
It's designed for that. I have a theory that if you just got rid of all of the scarcity stuff, so you could just travel from a room without having to worry about you know, I can only travel between rooms 50 times this day. Because what ends up happening on every run is that you run out of keys, and then all the keys that all the open doors that are available to you are all locked.
Yeah.
But you've run out of keys, and so you can't draft new rooms, so you're done. Or you run out of gems, so you can't draft rooms that you need that require them. Mm-hmm. That happens way before you run out of steps. So, like, why am I losing keys and gems at the end of a run? Like, it doesn't seem to, like, I don't get the mechanic there.
Why it doesn't carry over?
Because I reach zero most days anyway.
Yeah.
So why not just let me keep them? So on certain days when I just roll really bad and I get rooms with doors on the wrong side and get locked into the first row of rooms really quickly just by chance, which does happen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, your run could just be, like, stopped by RNG.
Yep.
The game does, I'm guessing, like all games like this, there are some hidden ways to keep you from failing too early that are hidden from the player. Sure. I mean, I suspect that's true because most games that do this have some affordance to prevent like a really quick loss.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's not quick enough. I'll get like a room, I'll have like seven keys, but then I'll only be able to unlock five rooms that time because they're all locked and I just draw bad.
Yeah.
And I'm like, great. Well, I would like to just maybe keep those keys for the next run maybe because I'm going to use them all and not get anywhere close to the next thing I need. And then, so I think some of the balance on that is off. Now that said, that definitely comes from my bias of thinking roguelike mechanics are purely padding. Like, this game could be way shorter, and I think it could be just as interesting. But I do have to go back to my first thing I said, which is that all of that randomness and the repeated runs through the house and building it differently this time than you built it last time is very core to the puzzle solving in a way that is so compelling. So it just frustrates me that there'll just be like a stretch of 3 hours where nothing happens.
It's also the thing that I keep latching onto is you're describing runs, and I think what you mean is the days.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are multiple days within a single run.
Are there? Oh, I don't know.
In this game?
I thought so. Like, no. Isn't it, don't you have like 5 days to get to the end of the house and then you start all the way over at day one?
Nope. Every day you start all the way over and you can do as many days as you want.
Oh, okay.
And I think people have been saying that you could expect to do it about 35 times.
So it'd take 35 days to get to the end of the house?
That's what I've heard. Okay. I don't know. I'm on like day 18 or something, and I feel like I've done a lot, but that tells me that I'm probably halfway through the game.
Okay.
Is my guess. Okay. Who's to say? I might be 2/3. I doubt I'm 1/3, but I'm just guessing I'm halfway through.
Sure. Yeah.
But yeah, it's every day everything is totally reset. There's a couple of permanent upgrades, but so far I've done 3, and I think... I've been avoiding spoilers and haven't been reading. I've just been seeing things on social media. I think there are only 3 or 4 in the whole game.
Oh, okay.
Of like permanent unlocks, which basically just make a certain area available later. But they're or like one of them just increases the default number of steps you get every day.
Oh, okay.
Because by that time the game knows it's super frustrating, so it gives you 50% more. And then it gets frustrating a little later.
And also, assumedly, that the house is bigger now, and so you by default.
It like, expects you to get further into the house, so you're going to need more steps.
In order to make more mistakes once you're in the deeper parts of the house.
Yeah. And to me, I'm just like, just lose that mechanic. It doesn't help at all. You know, but I mean, people have various opinions on this sort of thing. And some people like that stress. They like the stakes of randomness. They like that sort of frustration. And so that brings me to my topic for today.
Hey.
Which is friction by design.
Yeah.
I'm going to give this some taxonomy. This is neither here nor there.
Okay.
It's just a way to organize this topic, but there are other ways to organize it.
Yeah.
But I'm going to talk about good friction and bad friction.
Okay.
So good friction is basically like intentional, right? You're making a game that has challenges. That's friction. That's good friction. Mm-hmm. Now, we tend to think of that in terms of mechanical difficulty, right?
Yeah.
Like this pit is really far to jump across, so you have to get a running start or time it just right.
Yeah, or this boss is really difficult.
This boss only opens its third eye every so often. You got to watch for the signs.
Okay.
That's friction. You can't just shoot whenever you want.
Right.
There are other types of friction that are good. Mm-hmm. And roguelikes are one where there's the debate about it, right? Like people like me who think it's just the worst genre that is just padding, hate everything about it, will never be moved on that subject. Like I think that's bad, but it is, I would put it in the category of good friction.
Sure.
Yeah.
It is by design.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's a distinction I'll make when I talk about good and bad. Bad friction is all the stuff we talk about as app developers, right? UX stuff, things that we're trying to make the life easier for players. You know, we talked about quality of life on the show before. And one of the things about that is that sometimes it's kind of hard to tell the difference between, I want to make this really easy for players to navigate, like, you know, like a skill tree or something. But I actually don't want them, I don't want to make it so easy that there's no longer any gameplay challenge.
Right.
Yeah.
And as games get complicated, And as games are less reliant on like timing and twitchy skill, mm-hmm. Which is true of a lot of games, then a lot of the gameplay happens in menus.
Yeah.
It happens at consoles and kiosks within a world. And that's very much UX. And if you think only as a UX designer, as an application developer, you're getting rid of all of that, what you think is bad friction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But some of that you actually want to design in as good friction.
Right.
Yep.
Because it's so easy to conflate those things.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about examples in the work that I'm doing right now, because both the games I'm on are very UI intensive, mm-hmm. and also very meta. And so that line is extremely blurred in the work that I do. So I'm very in tune to thinking about that now.
Okay.
But I want to talk a little bit about sort of just broader examples in gaming. And I think we've been talking about Civilization.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And Civ 7, the big thing everybody hates about it right now is its UI is very, unfinished, it feels, is the critique.
That's a good way of describing it.
I give them a lot of grace for a lot of this stuff. It's extremely difficult. It's a game of buttons and menus.
Yeah.
But certainly as a player, I'm baffled by a lot of the choices it makes and a lot of the things it left unfinished. And particularly the wild variety of interaction models.
Yeah.
For all of its different menus and systems. There's some arrows that cycle through things, and then some things are just a scroll lists, and some things are available, are only hidden in menus, and some things are available as icons, but also as menus.
Mm-hmm.
And like a lot of it seems very independently evolved. And a lot of that is because Civilization has a long history of player expectations, mm-hmm. but then they try to change some things, but then they keep those other things the same because everyone's familiar with it. There's mm-hmm. There's a timidness to the evolution of how Civ 7 works, which makes it easy to get on board if you've played an earlier Civ, even going as far back as 4.
Yep.
It didn't take you that long to know where things were and what to do generally.
Yeah.
Broadly. And then the specifics is probably what threw you off, and certainly the new mechanics that were unfamiliar you had to learn.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, what that means is that all of that, the weight of that knowledge carried forward, prevents you from making more consistent or more declarative decisions about how to use a thing.
Yeah.
And so I would describe that as bad friction.
Yeah. It's also,
none of that is by design.
It's also hard to tell when there is friction because you haven't gotten to a point where you have full control yet. So one of the ones being the resource allocation.
Yeah.
So when it comes to like luxury resources, you can give them to cities so cities have the benefit of things like jade or incense or silk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But consistently, I could only assign them to my capital, but my other towns had a little box with a little ad symbol in it that was slightly grayed out, but it wasn't clear. It looked like, okay, well, maybe it'll be that's grayed out because all my resources are allocated, but then how do I remove my resource to then reallocate to my town? But actually, I can't do that. That to me, in an optimistic sense, would make me think, okay, well, maybe eventually this is the type of thing that I could allocate a resource to a town.
Yeah.
And there's only, it's small, so there's only one space for a single luxury good.
Right.
But just clicking on it, and it seemed like I could do it now. So the idea that it is something I can do in the future if I know how wasn't communicated.
Right. And because of the layout requirements of that page, mm-hmm. you need to fill a lot of space because you can have dozens and dozens of icons on it. So so it's a modal screen that fills a lot of the screen.
Yeah.
That when you do something you're not supposed to because you can't, you get a little tooltip in the upper right of the screen where no other tooltip in the game ever appears.
Yeah.
And so you don't see it.
I would also almost rather be able to remove all of the resources from my capital, see that I can't add them anywhere else, and then just put them back.
Yeah.
I'd rather be able to make that mistake than click on the resource and it not go back to the left where I could then reallocate it to the capital.
Right. There's a lot in Civilization, the UI, that is very much try it, and if it doesn't work, now you know.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Rather than like giving you a way to intuitively understand what you can and can't do.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about the resources system in Civ 7 is there are many types of resources that have different rules.
Yes.
They're all governed on the same screen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All the icons are independent little pieces of things, and they don't, the categorization, I don't know if they have a border that changes them.
They have a little border.
I don't,
it's not
I
very clear.
It out. Yeah. No. You can hover over it, and it gives you an idea of what the bonus is, but it doesn't really tell you, doesn't clue you. You kind of have to piece together the three or four systems as part of that thing.
Yeah.
Now, that I would describe that as not good, but it is good friction, uh-huh. right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the idea is that there's a whole thing that frustrated me that is new, I think, in the patch, where if you don't assign a resource, you get an unassigned bonus.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And when you assign it, you get a different bonus when you assign it. And I think the idea there is that there's some like choices you make.
Oh.
That's good friction because then you have some like choices to make. I think it's bad gameplay. I think it's bad design, but that's good, kind of good friction.
But then also, why can't I unassign my resources from my capital?
And yeah, that's that is the bad friction.
Yeah,
right. That is the UI bad friction. And so that is where I think the conflation happens. You can have good friction and bad friction that is part of your design.
Yeah.
Right. And then you can have good friction and bad friction that is part of your UX.
Yeah.
And it's not just that good friction, whether it's a good choice or not. And I know I'm confusing these terms by having different definitions for them. I apologize. Okay. But like it can be a good or bad experience, but good friction is not just design.
Oh, sure.
And it can be a good or bad experience, but bad friction is not just like menus and UX and stuff.
Okay.
Right?
So if I'm understanding this correctly, bad friction is basically just friction that was not intent. Well, you said it was not intended by.
It's the kind of thing that you would fix in a bug report.
Yeah.
Right. And good friction is something you're designing for.
Yes.
But you can do that design within things that are not just the strict gameplay part of the system.
Yeah, okay.
Like bad friction does not have a reason or intent behind it.
Yeah.
Because like the first. One example I was thinking of is we had talked about earlier in the roundtable about Let's Plays. I mentioned endoparasitic and the fact that you play a character who literally only has an arm.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to do everything with that one arm. So, for example, if you want to walk or crawl, you have to put your gun away or you have and then you move. And then if you have to then reach back and open up your bag or grab your gun, you can't move and do that at the same time because you're locomoting with the same limb.
Sure.
Yeah.
That is friction. That's difficult.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that has a reason behind it.
Right. That's good friction for sure.
Yes.
Yeah. And that level of frustration that the designer calibrates is what makes it good friction.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you can have, so for example, I'm just pulling out a rant, like you have a third person action game and you have parries, for example.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you want to make this a more intricate, rich system. So you like, well, I'm going to do like a up parry and a down parry, depending on if like, you know, someone's doing a leg sweep or they're trying to punch me or whatever.
I just described Soul Calibur.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Let's say I wanted to design a system like that. But then I design all my enemies to, instead of doing punches and kicks, most of them have guns or swords.
Yeah.
And so the up and down parry, even though it's like assigned to two face buttons, just doesn't get used that much.
Yeah.
Or doesn't really matter to, and so the player gets deep into the game without having to really engage with that system.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then suddenly a boss is entirely dependent on that.
Yeah.
I'm imagining a scenario.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would describe that as like, even though it is part of the design of the game, I would say that's bad friction.
Sure.
Like that's something that I would call that a bug.
Yeah.
Like even though it is a design choice. Mm-hmm. And so again, this is all kind of here nor there. It's a little fuzzy. This is an everything is everything topic.
Mm. Yeah.
But you have to kind of interrogate your own systems and really make sort of a almost philosophical choice on like, is the trouble here, is this good friction or is this bad friction? And that choice has almost nothing to do with like what it literally is in the game, I suppose. And it's very subjective.
I think like, or at least when I think of should this be hard, I guess, is, does it serve a purpose in and of itself?
Right.
And is it there in support of other things in the game or are other things in support of this decision
right.
in the game?
Right.
And one of the things that I think also complicates this when it comes to UI specifically is when you're designing UI, you have to also make decisions of how much are we going to protect the player or the user from themselves? And that can cause a lot of friction that is bad because the alternative is it could be even worse.
Right.
And
right.
that makes it hard to design.
Yeah. So, okay. So let's go back to Civ 7 because we all played it. And I'm sure listeners have played it at this point. I don't know.
If not, talked about it you could.
Yeah. Okay. So the resource screen, maybe part of, I'm trying to understand this concept better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe one of the reasons why they designed it in the way that they did is because for the most part people it's fiddly bit and people mm-hmm. don't need to worry about the fiddly bit of this resource management. It's like the this is the most micromanagement stuff that like Civ 7 gets is the resources where you put them in things.
Yeah.
For the most part, like they've removed a lot of that little micromanagement.
You just have this like pile of buffs that you can assign.
Yeah.
It's really fiddly.
Yeah. So it's really fiddly. And so maybe they made it annoying so people don't do it that much. But then like why put it in the game? I don't know.
If I had to guess, it would be that overwhelmingly it is more beneficial for a resource to be allocated to a city than it to not be.
Right.
And I still don't know why it seems like I can do it for towns, but I can't actually do it for towns. I would guess that they're protecting you from unallocating it to your capital and then going, why does everything suck here? Yeah. It auto-populates for your cities, but it's trying to make sure that if you don't touch it, if you never see it, or if you looked at it once and messed with it and then left and forgot it existed, that you would still get the buffs from your luxury goods being allocated to a city.
Yeah.
Would be my guess, allegedly.
Yeah. Well, of course, when you get a resource that's within a certain city, that's where the city it gets assigned. When you move it to another city, it even has a little notion of like where it came from.
Yeah.
And that has its own mechanical implications.
Yeah.
That's not well explained. I would say the system is so complicated and very poorly explained that like it is just a mess of like good and bad friction in a way that
I'm okay with it being a mess if I can mess around with it and decide I don't want to deal with it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't even afford me the chance to mess around, see that it's complicated, and then decide, nope, I'm out. I'm going to just leave it here.
Yeah.
The Civ 7 hate hour. This is where we're at.
But, well, that speaks to sort of the sort of hypothetical I was laying out, which is if your design is such that it's interesting but doesn't serve a pillar or can be just ignored by the player.
Yeah.
Then, like, what is the point of it? And that sort of maybe is outside the scope of this topic, but is where you might say, like, well, philosophically, I would say that this is design friction, but I would say it's bad friction because all it does is confuse a player.
Okay.
Because it's not servicing what we're trying to explain to them, how we're trying to deal with them.
Sure.
And they will just nope out of it, and then they'll be fine, but then what is the point of it? Mm. Yeah. But again, it's all just a matter of degrees in a certain sense.
Yeah.
This is also the way I feel about, like, RNG in games. Like, a lot of times it can be good friction because the idea is to prevent players from over-optimizing, which is a thing that I believe in as a designer. Like, I don't want players to fully understand a system so well that the only players who are good at it are the players who have mastered every corner of it.
Yeah.
That's where I think RNG is very helpful because it teaches players that they should not be obsessed with these systems.
Okay.
They should just play this game.
Okay.
And I think that's really important.
And be open to potential synergies and optimizations they may not have realized. Like you are forcing them to acknowledge you don't have to have one build to win. And hopefully open them to the opportunities that there are weirder ways they can win.
I mean, sure. I just don't want people obsessed with games to that degree. Like, I just don't like that as a designer. Yeah. I don't want a major league player of any game I ever make. Like that's a failure of design, I think.
Yeah.
But that's an opinion. So randomization can help with that, but at the same time, randomization is a core part of gameplay can be a very frustrating loop, and that's also why I don't like roguelikes very much because it encourages that kind of optimization, but denies it to you anyway.
May I give a example of good friction, bad friction within the subgenre of RNG?
Yes.
So original Oregon Trail, every screen, if you got out of your wagon, you were on a screen and things would populate and you can like hunt or get berries.
Yeah.
All of the places of locations of rocks and bushes and things was random, which meant that there was entirely a chance and a very real chance that you could spawn and get stuck and not be able to leave the screen or do anything.
Yeah.
Like you would, that is a critical bug that is cannot play that I have to shut down the game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what The Binding of Isaac did, which was a clever way to get around that, is they made rooms that they could test and make sure were not too hard or had an interesting, like were interestingly laid out that had, you know, elements like had spaces that could be randomized but were not themselves random.
Yeah.
So that way they never had the issue of you spawning and being surrounded by bushes and not being able to leave and then dying and losing everything because it's a roguelike.
Yeah.
So then they fixed the bad friction within their RNG and within their randomization. So that way they could focus on and try to develop and make better the benefits of the RNG that they wanted. And that feeling of exploration room to room.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Because I see your point, and it makes a lot of sense for Binding of Isaac to work the way that it does.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like at least the reputation that Oregon Trail has is that it's, you know, it's punishing and like randomly you get this entry or whatever, and then that's it. And that feels like that builds the game in a way that I think makes sense for that game. Like you could just randomly lose.
It's kind of part of the message of the game. There's a difference between randomly losing because you get dysentery and you die, and you randomly losing because your character is stuck next to a bush that feasibly, if you are a human, could walk through walk over, but you physically cannot.
Yeah, that's a fair point. That's a fair
point. It's the same system expressed the same way, but one example doesn't serve the design of the game, and one example does.
Exactly.
Right.
Or at least it's not as communicated as well.
And the everything is everything about this, is that it's not always easy to categorize things based on literally what it is.
Yes.
It's part of the context of the whole.
And the thing is that where they have randomization in The Binding of Isaac can screw you over. I've had a run, I don't know how I survived as long as I did in it, where four floors in a row, I didn't find any keys, which meant four floors in a row, I couldn't open the shop or the item room.
Oh,
yeah. I somehow survived on boss rooms and I think the devil room, maybe the angel room, I can't remember. But that is purely because, you know, wasted bombs early, didn't get any more bombs, couldn't find any keys. That random number generation failed me in that particular run. So I could still move around. I could still advance and be skilled enough, apparently, to advance four floors. But, you know, sometimes it just sucks.
That gets to a part of, like, well, then it becomes a matter of taste and opinion at a certain degree. So I think what I want to talk about to sort of close this topic is more UX stuff, the other side of it where you feel like all of this is bad friction, but actually areas where you might want to introduce some good friction. Mm-hmm. And so so I'll use just examples from the two projects I'm working on. So in Dream Settler, one of the things that we're focusing on right now, because it's part of this Patreon that we're doing, is the markup language that I wrote to describe what pages look like in the game. It's a development tool, but it actually has a specific design that I created. I've talked about it on the show before, but I want to talk about one specific example, which is, if you know HTML, there's a property called display, which just describes what a particular piece of content, how it is rendered in relation to other content. So, does it flow with the page?
Yeah.
Is it anchored to a corner? Mm-hmm. You could also say display equals none, which just hides it, even though it still exists. And so it isn't drawn or considered with the flow of the page. My markup language has something very similar. And the four categories that I use, which is fewer than HTML, are all sort of like ocean nautical terms.
Oh.
Okay.
For no particular reason, except to give them a sort of narrative cohesiveness. But the friction is that one of them is called flow, F-L-O-W, which you think like a flowing river, and also a page flow. Mm-hmm. So it has a kind of metaphorical connection. And then the other one, where it just sort of hangs out separated from everything else, is called flow, F-L-O-E, like an ice flow.
Oh.
So it has a metaphorical connection. So that there's some narrative world building to the structure of it, because this language is part of the actual world as well as the actual real-life dev tool.
Right.
That is a specific friction I introduced, having those things being pronounced the same, because the game is about internet culture.
Yeah.
And about how things are
written and not said.
And that's a big part of internet culture in a way that is like, that's why no one agrees on how to pronounce GIF, because, like, you know, no one says it out loud except when they're arguing about it.
Right.
Mm. Right? It's the only context in which you would ever say it out loud, really, or mostly. And so that's why that's the case. It also leads to those misunderstandings. And it has a larger, interesting thought about, like, the nature of written language and spoken language is extremely different from each other.
Right.
You have people who have developed relationships through spoken language. Those are different relationships than you have for written language and spoken language in a way that you may not understand if you don't appreciate what the differences are. And I think that's a strong theme for the type of game we're making.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a piece of friction I introduced within the specification of how to write the documents to leverage that notion, to get you to stop and actually slow you down and frustrate you, but then so that you can think about that more.
Right.
In a context where you wouldn't normally be thinking about it, even within the game we're making.
Mm-hmm.
So that is an area where you would have a bug report or a feature request. You say, hey, make these terms clearer.
Yep.
And I would say, no, that's good friction. We're keeping it. Won't fix.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that is that's a core part of sort of an example of what I'm thinking about when it comes to the other side of this, where it's about something you would mostly mistake as a UX thing or a quality of life thing. It's like, actually, that's something that is actually core to the design in a way that you wouldn't have expected.
Right.
Yeah.
So another example is from this other game I'm working on, this unannounced FMV game. So the in the menus, one of the things that we're doing is there's a meta quality to this that will make more sense when the game is announced, but we have lots of little menus. Mm-hmm. So you spend a lot of time going back and forth in and out of a lot of different menus.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a friction we're introducing because the idea is that the system you're using is within the universe of this thing is also tedious and complicated and maybe even poorly designed within the universe of this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we want it to be well designed in that we want players to be able to peek in and out of a menu, navigate, discover what this submenu means.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're giving them kind of like obtuse terms that are a little bit strange. That's friction that we're introducing. But one of the things that I've been pushing for on the team and having to like make this argument is we need the back button in all our menus at the top, not at the bottom. Because we want people to be able to quickly get through this stuff.
Yeah.
We don't, having it at the bottom, when you do a new menu, you have to go down 6 or 7 items to go back. That discourages you from opening a menu. That's bad friction.
Yeah.
Because we're not actually trying to make it harder to navigate the thing.
Yeah.
We're trying to make it feel like it's hard to navigate the thing.
Sure. Yeah.
And that's a very different kind of notion.
Well, especially because there is an emotional component. You don't want the snap moment feeling to be, oh God, not again, or this. And because that is the thing that will stick, and that will be the thing that prevents you from, like, that emotion especially is going to prevent you from exploring.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you don't want that, for especially for this type of game that you're describing.
Yeah. And we need to introduce this, we need to solve this bad friction in order to enable the good friction.
Yeah.
Right. And those things interrelate, even though they are literally the same literal thing.
Mm-hmm.
They have two different different types of experiences.
Yeah.
If we had, like a lot of games, you have a settings menu, a save slot menu, and a continue button, and that's it, and the settings menu has two submenus, then it's actually not that important where the back button is.
Yeah.
Right? And so you would want to maybe put it in a way that is at the bottom so it's out of the way so you don't accidentally click it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a kind of friction you'd want to solve, whereas what we're doing is where you're going to be poking around and it's part of the experience of playing. We want that at the top, so the good friction of navigating a maze is not impeded by bad friction of like, I don't want to look behind that door.
Right.
Yeah,
right?
I think it also, maybe this is thinking too deeply about it, but I think it is a very clear, in the social transaction that is between the dev and the player, it is a very clear acknowledgement of the player's agency to leave if they want.
Mm-hmm.
And that recognition is very powerful, and it's something that you don't really think about or see until you see it.
Yeah.
Where given the option to opt out in many ways, and I think a lot of people talk about this in terms of, for example, triggers or content warning, like good ones that then give, like, that are well structured that allow people to opt out of certain things. That power given to the player in recognition means that they can opt in fully and freely to the rest of your game.
Yeah.
And that's like a big extrapolation, but I think like just those little decisions, I think that's why they feel so significantly powerful, and that's why they are good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, again, everything is everything.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Just circle back to that. But I think this is definitely something that we lack, and it's kind of why I was trying to provide some. I don't know, I did a great job, but like find some way to describe these kinds of things.
Sure.
Because I know that certainly on the teams I'm working on, having to actually explain like what it is and why it's that way is like, oh, right, this is a concept that's actually unfamiliar to a lot of people, even working in games.
Yeah.
Right? Even working in building systems because we're really not, we're making these pretend real things.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. I suppose the context in the games that you are working on, particularly Dream Settler, you know, it's supposed to be within a real world, and it's, you're building a tool that was built in a real world. And so
it's probably easiest to explain in that kind of work because it's, the whole game is full of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. But I think in general, as game developers who hear players complaining about things, we are oftentimes encouraged to remove all of the friction from games.
Yes.
In a way that can cause harm to the actual full picture of the game.
Oh, 110%.
And I mean, I think that's effectively what
you've
been arguing.
We add systems that provide lots of options and features to a player that introduces a lot of bad friction.
Right.
Yeah.
Even in the goal of trying to give them agency.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, oh, actually, maybe we should have fewer options and fewer features because it's going to create many more minefields than our design calls for.
Yes.
Right? And it's hard to recognize that.
It is hard to recognize.
Yeah. You want to have enough that people feel like they can play with it and experiment with it, but not so much that they go, oh, it'll take forever for me. There is a very fine, you hit a point where convenience and ease overtakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the perceived cost of time and energy and ability of the player to figure it out is so outstripped.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's the subjective part of it too.
Yeah.
Okay. Blur time.
Yeah.
Blur.
You know, this, like, we should have played Glom like a little bit beforehand and then just had little phrases that we could describe to people how fun Glom is.
Yeah.
And like, so people understand how ridiculous the words that you will end up putting into a sentence together.
But listener, we didn't do that.
We did not do that.
So it's going to really hurt the efficacy of this call to action. You're going to have to imagine we're doing a better job of explaining how fun this game is by example.
I have an idea. Uh-huh. If you go to nicegames.club/Glom, mm-hmm. there are examples.
Uh-huh.
That's right. There's actually a full playthrough that we did for the Hand-Eye Society's wordplay conference.
Yeah.
Years ago. I love those folks.
That we did, that you could get a really solid idea of what the game is and how it works. And also on that page, some handy purchase links.
Ooh.
Whoa.
How convenient. Yes, you can go to nicegames.club/Glom. Check out the cut.
All right, Lydia, rumor has that you have a topic for this episode as well.
Wow, that is, rumor is true. It's not a rumor. It is, in fact, fact.
Ooh.
One of the two major things that have been constant friction in my life, not great, is the fact that we need diverse scoring.
Okay.
So the premise of scoring in general that I have found and agree upon is that scoring should be tied to the behaviors that we want players to prioritize.
Yeah.
Like, we want to have meaningful reward or indication that you are doing the thing. And so that tells you what you should score, have affect your score, but also to what extent,
right?
In training games, which is what I've been primarily working on, the first priority is practicing and engaging with the learning content.
Okay.
The problem is that there's very little diversity in the score if you only score based on your engagement or knowledge of the content, because the, like, if you have it on a leaderboard, because the best players learn the content and there's only so much content.
Right.
So you're going to have a leaderboard of the top 10 people with exactly the same score.
Yeah.
The problem is, so previously, like, this can be fixed with timers, fixed, quote unquote, but timers are not accessible. I would argue that they're anti-accessible. And that only goes so far. Because you're only changing increments by a certain amount. And also, like, at some point, you will have kind of a baseline of the people who know the content the best will just, it'll just be based on reaction time.
Yeah.
And so in the games that I've been working on, I've been prioritizing, you know, first and foremost, knowing the content, and then secondarily, engaging with the game. And that means a lot of different things, but specifically for the game that I've been working on, trying to find lots of smaller little things that will give you points at the end.
Okay.
The other, I mean, part of it is also there is an issue with scoring for me in general, is because this is going to be handed off to people who will add their content to the game, and then in turn handed to the players who will be playing the game. The scoring has to be understood.
Yeah.
And that is a particular problem for us, because we have that middle person, that author, who wants to know, like, hey, how much is a score going to be max versus minimum? Like, how much can you get from any given thing? Or where are people getting points? Are they getting it from the content? Because score is one of the analytics they're going to look at for player performance.
Yeah.
Learner performance, really. In general, if you have a game with score, you're going to need to look at, the player's going to need to be able to understand how they're getting points, because then that's going to then, because they need to then have the agency and permission to then say, okay, if I know how people are getting points or how I get points, I'm going to do more of that if they want to.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, and that can vary with games, right? I mean, Binding of Isaac, you do have a score. I don't look at it. I don't care. Mm-hmm. I'm there for other reasons, not score. But people do, if that is something that you want to pay attention to, that is something that you can actually tell. Okay, if I do X, I get a bump of the score roughly this big. And then you can spreadsheet warrior all you want. Yeah. But that's the problem. How does one have a varied score that is still linked to the right things, but have them be meaningfully different from each other?
Right. Okay. So I have opinions on scoring in general. I find them to be out of date a lot of the time.
Yeah, I mean, agree.
they have an important purpose, but I think that oftentimes we kind of just, well, I think we've gotten a lot better about this as game devs in general now. But in the past, I think we would put scores in games because all games had scores.
Yeah.
That I don't think that's really the case anymore. But in the past, oftentimes you would just get scored based off of like how many coins you collected,
yeah,
or how quickly you got through the level and things like that. And ultimately, scoring is just meant to allow the player to gauge how well they performed.
Yeah.
Based off of the game developers deciding on what is important in terms of your performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so like in Mario, for instance, it's not very valuable because like, it's not like that score ever comes back. You don't get graded on it. There's no, you don't have any really context to understand why you've got, you know, these 5,000 zeros or whatever it is. Like a lot of.
Well, also the things you get scored on are like, you know, do you squash a Goomba, collect a coin, you get 100 points here or there.
Yeah.
You get points for, it's a mix of things you care and don't care about.
Yes.
So the final number is not that important.
Yeah. Exactly. If anything, I would feel.
Because it contains at least 30% of metrics you're not interested
right.
in.
I feel like the coins are more effective as a scoring system because yeah. it. Rewards you for exploration, it rewards you for accuracy, and it has a benefit when you hit 100. I feel like the coins are a better score than the score.
Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah.
But one place that I think is really valuable to have scoring is in situations when you want players to like engage with the system, but they don't need to in order to get through the game. Mm-hmm. It's like a way to tell players this is a good thing that you're doing. And make it clear that this is a good thing that you're doing, but it's not necessarily important that you're doing this thing. And I'm saying this in terms of like beat 'em ups, I think a lot of times. I'm thinking of like Bayonetta or Devil May Cry. Mm-hmm. Those games have scoring systems and you get ranked at the end of like a fight.
Yeah.
Based off of how well you did your score. But ultimately, as long as you get through the level without dying, then you're fine.
Yeah.
The score isn't like super relevant. It doesn't like impact how your
it's a replayability opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all very score against your repeat performance, you're trying to get better and better.
Right.
Is a score based on how you're competing with someone else, in which case you don't really care what the number is.
Yeah.
You just want it to be bigger than your opponent's.
Right.
Or a certain amount bigger, but like, mm-hmm. again, it doesn't matter if you did better than you did last time or whether your opponent did last time. One of the things we did in Widget Satchel is we have a metric called the mischief score, which is hidden from the player until they reach milestones. And then it shows up briefly and goes away.
Mm.
And then you can find it in the menu, but like it's not part of the HUD.
Yeah.
And it's based on how much stuff you knock around.
Yeah.
And so as you play around and do goofy stuff, those points go up in the background.
Yeah.
And then every now and again, it'll say, hey, you got a million FYI. You're like, what was that?
Yeah.
And like, it's almost impossible to track.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because, and so all of those things goes kind of back to the friction stuff is like the how do you communicate scores to people?
Yeah.
And how do you... It's kind of to the root of your question, which is like, what is it that we're tracking and how are we telling people and what do we mean by that?
Right.
So here's some important context about this particular game.
Mm-hmm.
Because also like in my history, there was a time, my first game project, I actually advocated against using score for a very specific reason.
Okay.
But for this particular very specific reason is we don't have true turn-based multiplayer. We want to at some point, it's going to be a hefty lift,
mm-hmm.
but we want there to be a sense of competition with people playing the same game single player in their own times. So a leaderboard is actually important to this game's feeling of competition, and either with yourself, with the other people that are playing it. You know, we want that sense of competitiveness playing this game.
Sure.
Even if we don't have true turn-based multiplayer, you're not playing as a group, like you still have a sense of how well you're doing.
Yeah.
The kind of the vibe that I want in terms of competitiveness is like pub trivia.
Yeah.
I want you to be able to kind of do your own, be in your own little world, you or a bunch or people with you at the same screen. And maybe it's competing against your own knowledge, but you have a sense of how you're doing in the greater scheme of the pub trivia event.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that is how we can do it. I mean, there's other logistic things like we have other systems that, you know, will where score can matter or like you can get it. And there's I'm sure there's also authors and clients who want to be able to use score in order to like reward their people.
Yeah.
Or whatever. There's also definitely a hefty dose of like, you got to have score. Otherwise, who will play the game?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the way that like trivia works at Mars and things like that is like, mm-hmm. it oftentimes the trivia is so difficult that they don't expect anyone to get all the answers correct. Mm-hmm. And so you're just kind of, your score is effectively like, you know, how much knowledge you happen to have.
And this game is not for assessment. It is for practice, review, and mastery.
Yeah. So that feels counter to what you're trying to do.
Except that I have no control over the content that's going to be put in.
Right.
So I have no control about if the content is too hard, if it's too easy, if it's completely steamrollable.
That's kind of difficult because then the content creator who imports the content in it, they'll have their own sense of design of like, do they expect people to get everything right? Do they want to get everyone right? And then how does that work with competition?
Yeah.
Do you have to introduce a time factor or other things that you could then compare other players to?
Right.
In which case you've lost the plot as to what you're actually testing against.
Yeah. Right? The closest thing and the touchstone that I've been using the most has been Mario Party. Both because we've been trying to hit this party game vibe.
Yeah. Okay.
But also because I really like the fact that score, if we think of a score as being like coins and then stars as being competency,
sure,
coins are always less valued than stars.
Yeah,
competency is first. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that division and very clearly understood division of value is important, but that also people will still be impressed if they have 300 coins, even if they don't end up getting the stars.
So
That's what I've been trying to draw from them. That and things like Pummel Party that we actually got to play as a dev team together, which was really fun.
Especially
because like I want to reward competency and practice of the material overall. Trying to separate that out in a way that is valuable in metaphorically and obviously valuable metaphorically and also numerically.
Yeah.
That makes it a little harder too. I'm also just not good with numbers. This is an established fact.
Well, okay. I know you said you're not good with numbers, but what if we added more numbers?
Oh no!
So I think the issue is if you're trying to make a trivia game, you can't control the content.
Yeah.
You can't control how difficult it is. So you basically you want people to get all the answers correctly. So you can't test them based off of just that.
Yeah.
But you can test them based off of like their understanding of the content. So I guess it depends on the content, but like if you wanted to test people based off of like math, because you brought it up, you wanted to test people
this
based
is,
off
this
of
this is
math.
Because I brought up history so much.
Yes, I'm coming back. Then you could test their understanding on it based and give them questions that like you could give them like certain accuracy. Not describing it super great, but like basically, you want to allow for certain things to be granular in how you can determine how accurate they are. So like it might be like precision, like how many decimal places they get correct, like how many decimal places they fill out for pi. Don't tell them to do.
Yeah,
that, like.
Yeah. I mean that again is very much
that's content dependent, right?
Yeah,
it is content.
You're not
that's
be able
content
to rely on
dependent.
That.
One of the things I have been emphasizing also is trying to find more like data. Quantifiable ways that they engage with the game itself that I can measure. So thing like if we're talking about Mario, like how many bricks get broken, how many star question blocks get punched, how many Goombas get hit, items that get used, you know, how many times you reach the flagpole with a power up still active, those sorts of things that are, you know, computer trackable that feel like a significant, like you have engaged with the game in a significant way, whatever that means. Question mark and trying to find more of those within my own game to then give even just small kernels of score to further like differentiate. And then ideally, you know, even if they know the content, they may go, oh, I totally just ignored all the items or whatever. I'm going to go back and see if I like what these do or how much I can get.
And that just does the practice of repetition part. So what you're sort of talking about, and it feels like the natural conclusion to like not knowing if the actual questions, you know, the actual content is going to provide a reasonable metric. It may in some cases, it may not in others, because either it's so difficult that people get a random low score, and it's not that important if they get 20 or 30%, that's not really a big deal. Or it's going to be something that people will very quickly master and everyone will get 100%.
Yeah.
You can't control for that. Right. So what you're going to have to kind of do is acknowledge the fully decoupling of scoring metrics from the learning material.
Yeah.
And basically all you're doing is rewarding people's engagement with the system.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so that can be down to Betting mechanics. It could be just how quickly, unless this is something you don't want specifically.
Funny enough,
how quickly can they answer a question?
I did do an investigation on potentially adding a betting mechanic, like event thing, and I found that because score is so decoupled from progress in the game that it actually does not work.
Right.
Not for this game, for other games definitely, but just for this particular game because of other mechanics I don't want to go into just in case. It just it doesn't quite work, or it was the type of thing where like we would have to rechange the UI and the sense of value in score as a number in order for it to be valuable.
So
I think you're right, and I am kind of realizing that if everybody gets a trophy, I'm trying to get as many participation medals to as possible that they can then fill those trophies.
Yeah,
which is kind of an interesting way. Like you think of participation as you just showed up, congratulations, kid.
Mm-hmm.
But in games especially, it's in that kind of granularity of engagement and participating in the thing that is in front of you that in my context of training games, you're probably forced to do.
Yeah. Well, it's the thing that we don't normally like in gamification, which is that it has nothing to do with the material.
Yeah.
But you this is a system where by design it has nothing to do with the material.
Like which is
so you kind of have to
hard.
Just like acknowledge that and then design a system, even though it might not be the perfect way tailored for particular content, in order to make a genericized system, you do kind of have to do that. And therefore, the less you try to make it coupled to the material, the more successful of a game experience you can make it, in which case you'll get a better and more satisfying engagement, even if that type of engagement is not directly related to the material.
Yeah.
Right. So there is... I believe it was Huffington Post that had they have a trivia game where you can put more weight on certain categories than others.
Oh,
And so like what you would do is like you know if I would go on this thing and I would be like I know about video games.
Oh, like a called shot.
Yeah,
not a wager.
Yeah, a little bit like that. Ooh. So, but you don't know what the question is until you get to.
And
the
you
question.
Do still have some of the problems where if everything's a daily double, then everyone and you're going to get all the questions. Then it either doesn't matter what you weight, or you can weight everything high.
Yeah.
Or bet, you know, everything.
I might use that though because the player will have a sense of what kinds of questions they will be asked.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they are subdivided enough that one could have a called shot on that sort of thing.
Yeah. So that's a possibility is like making it so that like you're weighting things better. Or more important, based off of how you understand the material.
Yeah, that's a cooler version of wagering than what I was thinking. I was thinking very much Jeopardy Daily Double, where what you need in order for that to be a valuable strategic thought process or to have that agency as a player is you need to know what your score is. You need to know, have a sense of what the score of everyone else is. So that way you know if like what would be meaningful to win.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to be able to make that wager. But then also like another thing is you have to answer things like, well, can people go into the negative?
Yeah.
And what does that do?
Yeah.
Right? Does that mean how and what does that mean for your progress? If score is the only indication of your progress in the game, then that makes it a very clear, like that adds enough weight that it feels like a very good thing. If score is not as important as something else, some other marker of progress, not as much, then the wager's not as fun. But yeah, that's an interesting one.
Yeah, it's worth looking into.
Yes.
But yeah, I agree with Mark. If the material can't really service the scoring, then like the score has to be completely separate.
Yeah.
And you're just you're basically judging people based off how they've engaged with the game.
Yeah.
And hopefully, because they're engaging with the game, they're engaging with the material, and they will understand the material better as a result.
Yeah.
And you should be really open with players about that.
Yeah.
You
know, like, by the way, here's some questions. Like, and then, of course, the questions may, in fact, because you don't know, they may be difficult, in which case that will provide its own level of competitive element.
Yeah.
But you don't want a player to feel like they're being dragged around.
Yeah.
And, like, having to do these other little ancillary things. Like, you just design something that's interesting and fun, and then, by the way, here's some content, and let them know that they're decoupled, and that the more you try to hide it, the more obvious it will be.
Yeah, it's been very interesting, just in my new position, one, working in product as opposed to project. That was a major shift. But then also, again, this idea of decoupling the mechanics from the learning content is so antithetical to everything I've done so far.
Yeah.
And that's been very interesting because I have to throw away the core metric that I have used for my sense of if I am designing well.
Yeah.
It's very weird, but I guess maybe I'm not doing it so bad.
Well, it's tough because you're like, oh, this is an impossible challenge.
Yeah.
I can't solve it.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting. One of the mechanics we also were thinking about is having authors be able to designate some particularly hard questions.
Yeah.
But the problem is that people are notoriously bad at determining what is difficult and what
is easy.
Well,
that's the thing is you're doing this sort of co-development with an unseen collaborator who you have no idea is going to be good at it. And they are also, in fact, a customer / user of the system.
Yep.
So you need to design so that they are not burdened, essentially, with the design they're burdened with.
Right. I've been working very closely with our UI designer for the maker, the thing that they will engage with to add content to the game that we're making, and it is hard.
Yeah. But then also, I think one of the things that you have to sort of give yourself an allowance for, or maybe even draw back from what we've been talking about, is if you want to put some of the weight of the success of the system on the content provider, then in which case what you need to do is provide some training materials for those people. Say like your content should have things that, you know, or this or that. And if they are not able to meet that brief and the game it fails or isn't as successful, then it's not on you.
Yeah.
So then that becomes a question of like how much do you want to put on them?
Yeah. And what's the main thing? So there's a fair... We want to, in general, and that's also part of my job on the UI, UX, like CM, content management system side, is how do we make it in such a way that we are making it easier for people to make better games. And so teaching best practices, linking to previous resources that already exist, you know, and making sure that's all available but not overwhelming. One of the things is I'm trying to get low-hanging fruit and not try to go so hard in training is because I know people are going to use this game for assessment. Mm. It is fundamentally not designed for assessment. Not even that it's not ideal, but like physically it would not work because the game experience of one player could have potentially different content than the other and you could have the same score.
Yeah.
Like that is how the game is designed because it is designed for replayability, review, and practice. It cannot... Like, it is not a good assessment. But I know that people inevitably are going to use it for assessment.
Yeah.
So that's been the main thing that I've been working with marketing and sales is saying, like, this is not for assessment. Literally cannot be for assessment. People will use it as assessment anyway. But they need to understand that they are assessing two people who have played completely different tests. Tests, quotation marks, if they're thinking it's that way.
Yeah.
And trying to find ways to make that clear and ideally find... like suggest avenues where it's like, if you want to have this be a part, then lead into an assessment, here's how you would do it. Because this isn't one. You shouldn't be one. Right. Please, dear God, don't use it as an assessment and expect your learners to have to have reasonable data.
Yeah.
You're not going to have good data. Ah!
Yeah. Learning is difficult.
Yeah.
Feels like we almost solved this one.
Well... Yeah.
I just want to pat myself on the back because, you know, we never come up with solutions. Today.
I sitting here being paid to do this don't feel as like it is solved. But for exactly the reason that Mark said, this is an impossible design. It is a design problem and I don't have a solution. Yeah.
Well, drawing a circle around the problem can sometimes be progress.
I feel better.
Yeah. And I think that's where we got, which is, you know, that's a big win.
Yeah, I definitely...
That sounds like a solution to me.
I feel much better about it.
Yeah.
And that is honestly about as much as I could expect.
Cool.
Thank you.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
Your child has so much potential, but your local schools may not be right for them. Check out K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited tuition-free online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.